Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 133 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So with us here this episode to help us break down and discuss and mourn and lament and blah, 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 this most difficult chapter are our friends Diane and Arlen. And it's been a little bit since we've had them on the show, so we want to say, first of all, a big hello!
And hi!
just before we get started, see how you guys are doing and what you guys have been up to. You guys have been kind of busy.
We have. We've been very, very busy. So Diane has been, on top of working full-time, she's been doing grad school. And we're also, and have been for quite a while, pretty heavily involved in the SCA, which is sort of medieval reenactment and stuff. And she took on the pretty massive job last summer of being basically an assistant and tour manager to the Queen in charge of our sort of local area. So she got to spend like 6 months, maybe closer to a year, traveling all over. And so we've both just been really busy with that.
Well, and it's easy for Arlen to talk about what I've been doing, but he's had a lot going on too. He's got a new job and he's been exploring some new crafts. Arlen has started working on making leather shoes and brewing lots of beer. And so it's been, I don't know, it's been an exciting, I guess, about a year since we were on last.
I think, yeah. And I think, speaking of brewing, you probably already know all about how to make it, but I saw, put it this way, whenever I say anything about brewing, I always think I have to either share it on your page or I have to like put your name in the comment so you can come see it. But I'm sure like everything I would ever want to share or point into your guys' direction, you'd be like, oh, that's so sweet, Ginger.
No, it's like every cat video I share with Ginger, she's already seen like 12 times.
Oh, wow. You know, some of those good things in life, they never get old. Like chocolate.
No, some of them do.
Like beer is always going to be a wine.
Oh, no. Beer, beer and wine and all that, no, never gets old. Something I saw today, which is, from what I understand, I went to one class a number of years ago about this, and from what I understand, the oldest of the oldest known fermented brewed beverage, and I promise I'm not drinking, is mead.
That doesn't surprise me to hear. It's really, well, first of all, it's so simple to make, but also if you have something that sugary, it's pretty hard to keep it from fermenting. And, you know, on its own, honey will resist that pretty well, but if it's exposed to air and there's water, I mean, it's something that would have come about accidentally, so.
You know, one of the interesting things, they do kind of like a new study every few years to try and figure out where was the oldest fermented beverage, when was it, what was it, that kind of thing. And one of the interesting things as far as mead, one of the old processes for getting honey from the hive, it didn't used to be the bar hives that you use today where you could just take a section out, drain the honey from that. You would have a hive and you would basically smash apart the whole hive to get to the honey.
Oh my gosh.
Now, understanding that, you still have a whole bunch of wax, a whole bunch of debris and stuff in there. So one of the ways they would deal with it is the hive would get cut apart and it would kind of get hung. And so you'd get your first runnings of really good quality honey that would drain out. Then they would have like a second runnings that's, you know, not quite as good, maybe has a bit of debris in it, but they'll clear that out. But then what they would often do is what's left over, they would put in like a bag, just a piece of fabric, and they would put it in hot water and boil it. And so all of the honey would dissolve into the water. And so then you have this really heavily sweetened water. And then you have a bag full of like wax and stuff that you can start using to process your wax. And a lot of people think that originally that was what was made into the mead was this, you know, third draining of the honey that was just mixed with the sweetened water already. And they think that perhaps at some point that water had been left out and, you know, with some wild yeast got fermented and people went, hey, we're going to do this some more.
Well, it's a little known fact that Ginger actually used to be an amateur winemaker.
Oh.
I started really young.
When she was, I don't know, what were you, four, five?
I was three.
Three, when you dropped your grape juice bottle behind the bed and then found it like 6 months later and tried to drink it.
Yeah, okay. I could have been four. So, between three and four. I mean, I don't remember that, but I'm told that story.
Apparently it wasn't a very good vintage.
No, it would have been a great vintage if I had waited 12 more years.
Right. If you just left it back there, it probably would have turned out lovely.
So actually, the reason I mentioned mead is because the thing I saw online was about how to make mead. And I thought, oh my gosh. And I thought, Ginger, resist. It's okay. You can resist. But
you can do it.
I know. Diane's like, yes, I mean, you may resist.
What does it require?
I didn't read it, but basically it's
just honey. Because we have lots of honey.
It's honey and water, and to do it, to make it happen like this century, it's the class that I sat in on years ago, they mentioned champagne yeast.
Oh, no.
You know? So one of the things that I have learned in my very limited brewing experience is that the thing about champagne yeast is that you wind up with something closer to champagne at the end, where it's pretty dry and it's pretty alcoholic. But the trick that a lot of people who like sweeter meads will use is they'll use either a beer yeast or even bread yeast, because what happens is eventually the alcohol content will start to creep up into, you know, the 5% range or whatever, like a decent beer. And then the yeast will stop being able to keep going, which means that the mead doesn't turn into, like, vinegar. Lighter fluid. whereas if you use champagne yeast, it's able to survive at higher alcohol content, so it just keeps fermenting and fermenting, and eventually you get something that has no sweetness left in it. So some of the best mead I've ever had is made with, like, Red Star bread yeast from the grocery store.
Really?
Yeah, so if you like it on the sweeter end of the scale, that's my tip. And really, I mean, it's as easy as, you know, one of those glass 1 gallon wine jugs from the grocery store wine that's terrible, and a packet of yeast and a pint of honey, and dissolve the honey in warm water, and then clean the jug, put those in, and let it sit for a couple of weeks. That's why it's often used by brewers as, like, the gateway thing to try and encourage other people to start, obviously.
That's the last thing I need. If I made alcohol that easy to come by in my house.
This will be the last podcast that ever goes out.
Thank you.
No, because I wouldn't be doing it. So I'd still just be here at my lonesome. And if some are ever like, I can't make it, then I just have to call all of our friends we met through the podcast or put out open invites.
You'd make me do it anyway. I would never drag you.
I might harass you.
You might bring the microphone to me on the floor.
No, because it has to be near the computer. But okay, so we're here to talk about, besides mead and yourselves, one thing in particular, and that is a certain chapter of a certain book.
I feel like this is how you led into the last time you had them on the show. I feel like if you go back and listen to the last time we had them on the show, I swear to you, it was almost the exact same intro.
Okay, so Summer, this is your job now.
So I suppose we're segueing onto the read-along section of this episode. This episode we are discussing chapter 46, entitled "She Likes It When I When I Try to Read These Things Out Loud."
For just a second, I was like, "Wait, did I read the wrong chapter?"
No, no, it's in Latin. I'm going to butcher it, and then she'll correct me. She likes correcting me. So, chapter 46 is entitled "Timor Mortis Conturbat Me."
It actually wasn't too bad.
Okay,
"Timor Mortis Conturbat Me." Yeah. So translated as "in which all things go to pot," but it does not really mean that. Of course,
It's like mortis means death, doesn't
yes,
it?
Okay. Yes, but the whole stuff, things go to pot. But the first comment I wrote before I even took notes, before I even wrote that line, is, "And here we go."
Oh, okay. How many N's?
This is, huh?
How many N's were in that?
Actually,
and?
One N and like four A's.
Oh, it was all A's. Okay.
Because I'm not going N.
You should have, though. It would have been funnier.
I don't release my notes, Summer.
What?
Because that would be too embarrassing. My notes.
Oh, I don't release my notes. I thought it was like the note you were holding when you were saying,
oh, sorry, the notes. Too many. When you get two singers talk, it was a crosstalk here. Okay, sorry. So this title that Summer just said is a Latin phrase commonly found in the late medieval Scottish and English poetry, translating to, quote, fear of death disturbs me, unquote. The phrase comes from a responsory of the Catholic Office of the Dead in the third nocturne of Matins. And we will provide a link to that Wikipedia citation there. Lisa T. writes, just from the title of the chapter, we know it's going to be a rough one. By the end of it, I wanted to say to herself, quote, have mercy on your characters and readers, unquote. But herself, being the tremendous author that she is, spares no one from unimaginable tragedy on the final push to Culloden.
No, and she's setting the tone for every other book that she ever writes, whereas she doesn't let up on her characters,
okay,
even a little bit.
When she did, because, I mean, it was BJR, but come on, everything is Diana. So when she did what she did to the hero in book one, mm-hmm. come on. She will never let anyone off ever, ever, ever.
But to me, this scene, or this whole chapter really, is harder to get through those scenes from book one. And, you know, maybe it has to do with the fact that Jamie's encounter with Blackjack is, although he does get to him emotionally, it's primarily a physical torment. And this is 100% emotional. No one is malicious. No one is trying to hurt anyone else in this chapter. It's just this painful experience that they cannot avoid. You know, Claire says it's kind of like childbirth. Like, you just got to go through the pain. And it's hard because on the outside, they're pretty much okay, but they're going through such sadness.
And the reason they're going through such sadness is, ironically, to save the maximum of the three of them that they can, and that is, of course, her and the little munchkin that I just spoiled.
Spoiler alert!
Well, I mean, hopefully people have read it.
I hope if you read it and you're not depending on us, you know. Oh, sorry, I spoiled you for about 45 minutes down the road.
Also, I would say that the difference between this chapter and then in the last book, the thing that happened there, is that this chapter, no one is intending to try to save anyone at the end. There is no hope.
Mm-hmm.
The way that this chapter is written, there is no hope. Like, this is how they intend to finish everything between them.
Absolutely.
That's one of the things that interests me, you know, with the title of the chapter. You know, like you said, it's call and response prayer. And it's often with this idea of ultimate redemption. And, you know, that glimmer of hope, and if we can just do this right, then everything will work out eventually. Used a lot, I'm not sure, I know it was used in a lot of English poetry, but it was especially used in Scottish poetry, like late medieval, and even up into like the 1800s, it was still getting used, especially when they started getting the, you know, the romantics were kind of hearkening back to a simpler time, which a lot of the time meant having these sort of medieval themes. And it was always used with this idea that, you know, you had these poems that were kind of, and here's the terrible pain of my, you know, misbegotten life / unrequited love / trying to deal with the fact that, you know, I'm a bastard and my father abandoned the family or whatever. But there was always this idea in the poetry of, you know, this ultimate hope, this fixing of things and somehow making things better. And with this chapter, it's like, it's very, very hard to see where that hope and where that redemption is.
Well, but, I mean, if you're going to go all Catholic, like Diana does, and the title, that description.
Sorry. Okay, that's, you know, what Jamie, the title of this episode is going to be, Wherein Diana Goes All Catholic.
Where she goes all Catholic.
... again.
You know, Jamie says he's not that scared of death, but he's kind of scared. And there are all these situations where both Jamie and Claire and other characters in this chapter are facing death. But the idea in her spiritual universe in these books is more that death is, at this point, the only thing that's going to fix or release or free any of them. Like, Jamie's not scared of death because he doesn't have that hope. He doesn't have anything else in his mind. So the idea of not being afraid of death is more an acceptance that this is what is going to happen no matter what I do.
There's 2 points in this chapter, and when we get there, I do have it in my notes. One point at which I will argue that Jamie has made up his mind about what's going to happen. But later in the chapter, Diana, through Claire, says that she could see that he made up his mind at that point. And I mean, I know it's from the author, so it's hard to argue with, but I actually disagree. I think there's a point at which we see Jamie making up his mind. He may not know exactly, 100% of the details or how long things will take, but I think he made up his mind a lot earlier in the chapter than is actually there's textual evidence for. I think there's textual evidence for it. It's just not literal until later on.
Well, and sometimes that happens where someone has made up their mind, but they don't know it yet. And they're already pushing their actions towards.
Exactly. Agreed. So basically, Jamie and Claire are making their way north. On the way, they pass men, tired and hungry, who are also making their way north. They pass men in ditches, men exhausted, who are hungry. They pass equipment and weapons, all abandoned. So she's already setting the scene for basically some kind of wasteland.
Well,
they're
following the retreat. There's nothing left.
Well, it's a retreat, but they're also being called. They're going north to actually stand again, which is the biggest ironic sadness. It's ironic that there's a retreat, yet they're going to also make a stand, a last stand. But it's just from before the chapter opens, it's just this wasteland and everyone is, if not out and out, dying. I mean, they have really bad nutritional illnesses like scurvy and everything that she talks about, including the prince. And just absolute abject existence. Misery. That's the best word. It is absolute misery. And yet they're trudging, hungry, exhausted, in the rain. It rained for days, including up to and during the battle, which I know we don't get into, but it rained. It sleeted? Is that a past tense correct form?
What would it be otherwise?
Sleet's a noun. Slut? Sleet's a noun. I've never heard it used as a verb.
It's slut.
It slutted. The sleet slutted well. But yeah, basically misery is what I get.
That's kind of part of what I love about this chapter, even though it's a horrible thing. I think a lot of the depictions that come to us about Culloden are, heroic last stand, and they bravely fought on, and people, I've even seen sketches people have done after reading the book, or some of the TV shows that have been made about it and things like that, and it's, you even get people sort of depicting it as this glorious sunny day, and, these big strapping Highland warriors going for a grand fight, and if you look at the accounts, it was horrible. People were frozen to the bone and so starved they could barely walk. I think one thing that's certainly, now that I'm sitting in Idaho, an Idaho spring is very different from a Scottish spring. And one of the things, especially in northern Scotland and especially northeastern, you can get these incredible biting North Sea winds, even pretty far inland. And if you're just trudging through soaking wet moorland and you're freezing cold and you're wet to the bone and you've got these winds as well, on top of being starving to the point where you're eating the animals meant to be dragging your military equipment because you've got no other option, it really just makes you dejected. And the reason these men fought on, a lot of them, wasn't because of some ideology. It was because they had no other option anymore. They'd already thrown everything they had into this cause, and they were now at this point where they either won or their entire life was ruined. They knew there was going to be no forgiveness after this.
I wrote down, and I will probably come to it, that it was bad enough that they're having to go on this, I'm sure they feel it if they didn't know it, on this hopeless cause, at this point, hopeless cause. And it's bad enough that they go to this, pretty much to them, hopeless cause, knowing that they're likely not going to survive. That's bad enough on its own. But to be basically ordered, drug, and be emaciated, eating horses, not even having horses anymore. I mean, and then of course the weather, which no one can control. It makes it more depressing. It's bad enough that they're going to their deaths, but they're being ordered to it, and the conditions are so awful that I don't see how you can get much more awful.
Yeah, this is one of those instances where it really rings true what Diana has said about that she likes to push her characters to their absolute limits. Like some of these scenes would not look that out of place in The Walking Dead. You know, that very first scene where Claire's walking in the forest and there's just a corpse laying there that no one has buried, no one has cared for, it's just some stranger. Like, this is a world where the rules don't apply anymore because everyone has been pushed so far past their limits. And the land itself can't really support it.
Exactly. And besides the weapons and the equipment that had been abandoned, speaking of food and not having enough, some food, was it bags of flour? There was food that was left to spoil, which to me is hard. That's hard to understand when they, is it because they...
If
didn't
it
have
was
enough
a,
men to
if
carry
it was
stuff?
A retreat means you're leaving. You get out of there or you die. And that means you may leave important things behind.
Like food.
Because you're taking your life.
With flour, you need fire to cook it. You need pots and pans. You need, equipment and oil and other things. So it's not like something you can just stick in your pocket and eat. So if it's heavy and it's a pain to consume, I can see why I have to go.
If I recall right, the sack had split.
Then that makes sense. They couldn't use it anyway.
A big, heavy sack. They're all exhausted. Probably no one had any other means of, separating it out and carrying it easily, so they were just like, well, screw it, we're leaving it here.
But just how sad. Can you imagine that moment where you're the soldier who comes upon this dumped-out bag of flour that could have fed your entire group, and you're all starving, and you're going, oh, man.
Again, Diana's describing this incredibly horrible... We haven't even gotten to, the third paragraph yet. And she's describing this awful situation of men, of people, humans, and then the weather, and then all these things with... all these things that have been abandoned. And part of the problem is of the conditions is that they are starving. And yet, as you said, there's this sack of flour that could have fed who knows how many people, but it's gone to waste because either it split and they just literally, started to empty and they couldn't save it. Yeah, I agree. It makes it almost, if it can get more depressing, it gets more depressing when you see that this food had to be left, whether it was because they couldn't carry it or because it split and it was just spilling out.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, there's no point in, of course, carrying it further. The date was April 13th, 3 days before Culloden. Rations were short. Our two protagonists are also among the hungry. But still, people moved north following the prince's orders toward Dramasi Moor, Culloden. They decide to cut through the wood rather than continue on through the heather. It was easier to walk on the soft ground there compared with the heather. They come upon, this is what Diane was talking about, they come upon a fallen man, his corpse. The only thing that made Claire not stumble upon it, literally, was the brightly colored fungus that was growing out of it. Diana writes, quote, "Soft as velvet, the strange fungus spread its cloak over the naked, cold white limbs. It followed the curve of bone and sinew, sending up small, trembling fronds like the grasses and trees of a forest, invading barren land." Unquote. An old soldier had told Claire it was called corpse candle, and that it was only seen on battlefields, and this is actually... even though, yes, I've read it before, so it could have been subconscious, but knowing about, black mold and mold in general, that spores can live, I don't know if you'd call it dormant, but they can live until conditions are right in the air. And that's what Claire was wondering or mm-hmm. thinks. Mm-hmm. Now, I looked it up and I couldn't find anything on Google called corpse candle, but I did find I looked up electric blue fungus, and if it's the same one, it's called Pulchericum chyle, excuse me, chyrullium. And the Pulchericium means most beautiful, and caerulium means blue. So most beautiful blue, and we will have a link for that as well. And
yeah, don't do what I'm doing. I just Googled corpse fungus, and you won't like what you see.
I was just going to say that. I did that this morning while I was like, oh, I should look for some things to talk about tonight. And no, nothing good comes up. And I really saw some things that I'm never going to forget.
Just the idea of thinking of a corpse fungus makes me think of something that they would have done on Hannibal.
Yeah. They did something close to that with the, they were growing mushrooms on that corpse.
That was really gross. I mean, there's a lot of things on Hannibal that were gross, but that, blah, blah.
Well, okay. That's one of those weird things I'm kind of fascinated by.
Corpse fungus?
Well, just...
Ladies and gentlemen, my husband.
I'm like, I don't think he was going to be that specific, Ginger, but go ahead, Arlen.
I read about the body form years ago.
Oh, yeah, I love that at the university.
And I keep thinking one day I'd really like to tour there, but then I think, no, really,
no,
I wouldn't.
No, don't.
I imagine you could smell it for miles.
But yeah, I think that the corpse they find is just one of the symbols of how bad everything is, that this person's probably just, like, walked off the road and collapsed and died, and there's not even anyone there to do anything about it. It's not even noticed. It's just this thing that happened.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Again, retreat. I just keep thinking it's, like, the things that you stopped caring about when your life is at stake.
Definitely. There's a... one of the songs that was popular during the Civil War was, I can't remember what it's called, but it's about how it's somebody contemplating that this dead person they come across is somebody's little boy and somebody's darling and somebody's sweetheart back home. And, you know, none of them are going to know that this person who was a person is dead, you know. And by the time Claire sees this corpse, it's not a person anymore. But, you know, that just disregard for someone's life is definitely a sign that things have broken down pretty far.
So Claire is there standing alone looking at the corpse and the corpse fungus when Jamie comes up behind her, urging her to continue on. She's like, yes, has. He's like, yes, has snack. We need to get going. They make it to Culloden on the morning of the 15th, so one day before the battle. There were men on the road when they get there, but the stables were deserted. Jamie went to check it out. Claire followed him back to the stable, and they see it's empty, save for an old man, who just so happens to be old Alec. I mean, that's a little bit almost too coincidental, but obviously we're happy to see him, but that's very coincidental. Jamie asks what has happened, because it's so empty in there, and Alec says it has all gone to pot. And that's where I thought, that's a perfect... episode title. He says the prince has said that they will take a stand at Culloden. Claire moans, quote, it was here then. Despite everything, it had come to pass, and we were here, unquote. The prince knows that the troops are ill ready for a fight, but he has said that they will fight, and so they must. The men had eaten the horses the last month. Jamie reacts to this. He's deeply saddened that Donis may have been eaten. But Alec says that the prince took Donis, he wasn't eaten. And Jamie is crying. And his reaction, quote, I'm a fool. The cause is lost. My men are being taken to slaughter. There are dead men rotting in the wood. And I'm weeping for a horse, unquote. But Alec says, and how correct is this? How true is this? Quote, it's as well that you still can, lad. I'm past it myself. I thought that's saying
something.
He was
past a lot of things. I'm pretty sure he was dead at the end of this scene.
Yeah, he was.
I'm pretty sure old Alec died at the end of this scene.
That's timing.
Like I said, it was like all of a sudden at the end of the scene, they walk away and they were like, oh, now his other eye was as unseeing as the other.
When they got up to Alec, they said he had one good eye, right?
Yeah.
And then when he was describing it before they had the conversation, they said his other eye was already clouded. So if I'm not mistaken, he was blind in both eyes before they started talking.
They made it sound like he became unseeing.
Well, and whether he's dead or just near death, it's clear that he doesn't really care one way or the other. And
yeah, because he just said he's past it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the line, I'm looking at it right now. I looked back at Alec when we reached the stable door. He sat quite still, a dark hunched shape, shawled in his plaid, the one blue eye unseeing as the other. So I don't know. He's either dead or he's just completely given up.
Yeah, that thousand-yard stare kind of thing. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I really felt for Jamie in this scene. It's kind of like, especially everything he went through with that horse. Like, pretty hard to comprehend the suffering of the tens of thousands of men who were there and all the horrible things that are happening. And that one animal is something that he can really comprehend. And that even an innocent animal, even though it was kind of a mean, innocent animal, could die or could be taken by this man who was Jamie's friend, you know, just feels like the last undignity, you know, the last straw.
Well, it also seems like the most ignoble death for that horse. Like, it would be like that particular horse who was kind of a jerk horse but was beautiful and regal and all of those things, and to think that his end was they killed him for meat. So I think that also maybe played into it as well. It was just kind of you're right, it was, there was no dignity if that had been his passing,
for sure.
So old Alec is past basically caring and or being able to care. And as bad as things are, Jamie is not beyond feeling and expressing emotion. So once you pass into apathy, you know things are really bad. If you're apathetic, you don't easily feel sympathy or empathy for someone or something, no?
Mm-hmm.
And or it's harder to.
You know, and Donis was kind of his companion, you know, his project, and he took this surly horse under his wing, even though he couldn't necessarily always handle him as well himself. And it's like saying, you know, this guy not only stole your girlfriend, but then he took your car and drove her on a date with it. Like, Charles has not only betrayed him and his country, now he's taken his horse and he thinks he's going to ride it in splendor down the streets of Edinburgh. And Jamie knows that's never going to happen, and he knows that, you know, his horse is pretty much as doomed as everyone else, but the horse doesn't have a choice, you know?
Exactly. Donis was an asshole, but he was Jamie's asshole.
Yeah.
For sure. For sure.
Diana
that
writes...
That visual doesn't work for me.
Well, I didn't have a visual. On. I just had
Now I'm thinking about Jamie's asshole. So if we could just move
on. You almost
on.
Get a glimpse of it in season one.
Oh, gosh.
Right?
Just ask BJR.
Whoa. He got a glimpse of it.
That's what I mean.
Just to laugh all the way through.
Okay. So Diana writes of the men in Culloden House, quote, "Men sprawled through the house, worn to exhaustion, seeking oblivion from gnawing hunger and the knowledge of certain and imminent disaster," unquote. How awful is that? You're starving, which is bad enough, and you have a pretty good idea that you're going to die soon. Both are bad when taken alone. But together, this is what goes back to what I said earlier. It's like, yes, this is, you could say this is Diana, but really, this is history. She, obviously, none of us were around right there, but we know the condition of the troops. We know what the weather was like. There are too many accounts. We know how they fared. I mean, dialogue she writes obviously is fictionalized, but the conditions, there's no doubt that it was this awful.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Or even worse. I mean, I don't know how you can get worse, but I'm sure you could. There were no women. Women who had been with the men or who had been with the group had been sent away. Jamie leaves Claire alone to go speak to the prince, and she wanders around the house. She ends up in a small lumber room at the top of the house. Now, I am not going to make a biblical reference at this point because I've already done that with Diana about the upper room, but it is funny that the next scene, big scene, you know, is all in this upper room, and it's during Pentecost. It's in the upper room when the Holy Spirit comes down and they begin speaking in tongues, the apostles. And here, yeah, no, that doesn't happen, but basically in the upper room is where the shizzle hits the fan, and yeah. Where maybe not the Holy Spirit, but the holy shit comes down. It comes down.
Are you sure you're not drinking?
I'm positive.
Good Lord, dropping that.
I've only said like the A and the S.
It's only minute. I'm sure the F is not too far behind.
Oh no, I don't do the F.
And then maybe the D. And then
Summer,
there's
stop.
All kinds of other ones we could probably come up with. I mean, if you're going, like, you should go for them all. It's like getting an EGOT, where you want to get the Emmy, the Golden Globe, the Tony, and the Oscar.
I don't mind an EGOT. I'm not going to go for all the bombs.
I'm just saying. This could be the episode.
No. Although if there was one, this should be it.
If you're going to do it, this is the time.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. Okay, so news of the death of Le Duc had traveled. Claire wondered if his death had doomed the Jacobite cause. Was that the one event, or one of them, that made Culloden an absolute certainty? Had they saved Charles from an English trap? Not only does she realize now that, okay, well, obviously, Culloden's happening, we're not getting out of this, you know, she's known for a while. I mean, come on. But it's kind of the, I won't say the fate, but it's the curse, if you will, of the time traveler or someone like Claire, who knows what happened, at least in her time. She knows the future of how it stood in her, when she was around. She knows the path of how it stood in her, whatever, all that stuff. She knows how Culloden went down when she was in the 40s. She knows from the history books. But now that she's there, and they've done their best, and they've unfortunately failed to try and change things massively, this thing that, you know, she had no, there was no knowledge of, no guess. She and Jamie didn't even do anything. It was all Murta. But did this event, or did this action by Murta, was that something small that contributed to the absolute certainty? We don't know. And that's why I could see something like that. Well, yes, it's vengeance of a way, of a type. All those little tiny things, they're like, okay, we failed in this and this, but oh my gosh, Murta, you had to cut his head off. I mean, all these little things that, you know, she's not sharing with everybody else, but in her head and in her heart, she starts second and third and fourth and fifth guessing. Oh my gosh, was that the thing?
One of the things a lot of historians have talked about is, was there ever ultimately a point where things could have stopped in such a way that Culloden would never have happened? And so a lot of people theorized, well, what if the prince at this point, when he sort of takes command himself, would have swallowed his pride and gone to the troops and said, okay, we're going to officially surrender on the basis that you guys get let go, that there's no reparations against you. And it was sort of pretty universally historians said, yeah, it wouldn't have done anything. Like, at this point, they were out for a blood hunt. And the general agreement seems to be, most likely, if the prince had stayed in Scotland rather than pushing down into England, wintered in Scotland, reprovisioned, things might have gone differently.
If he had stayed in Edinburgh, I have no doubt you would be saluting King Charles the 15th or whatever right now. I really think that his dumbest move was to walk into England with that entire army. And but you know, that's the if, you know, what was the little decision? What was the little butterfly flap of the wings that pushed things down that path? And just like with the Duke's death, you can't really know how those little things change history, or, you know, like Claire kind of speculates about at various points in this series. Maybe there are events that are just, they have to happen, or they're just so big that no one person could possibly ever affect the outcome. But she and Jamie sure tried.
And I think the tricky thing with time travel is that who's to say she wasn't always part of that timeline?
Yeah.
But these weren't the things that always happened. That's the thing. It's like, at what point do you know whether or not the original timeline wasn't always that she go back and be a part of the past? So it's hard to say whether or not they could have changed anything, because that could have been the change that had always been there from the beginning.
So the Culloden that she read about in her child's history book, you're saying, could have very well been the Culloden that she was almost a part of.
Yeah, or the Culloden that she was a part of.
Well, she wasn't at the battle, I mean.
Or the lead up
She's
to it.
She's the lead up to
it. Yeah.
Right, and that's the Marty McFly moment. Like, if exactly. She stopped it, maybe she would just fade away and disappear, and Jamie would be going, what? You know? Those paradoxes crop up over and over, and I think the only way that series like this one managed to successfully navigate it is just to kind of go, well, we don't really know. We can't really explain it. Maybe they can change things. Maybe they can't. You know, wibbly wobbly.
Timey, and, I love it. Timey wimey. Yep.
Exactly. And just kind of keep moving.
So she's up there in that upper room, and Jamie comes to her. He finds her. And the troops are moving to Culloden. They haven't slept or eaten in 2 days. They have no ordnance for the cannon. Keep in mind how outgunned they are, or were, in comparison to the government troops. So they, at least we now have evidence that they had a cannon. but, and Diana writes the canon, so I'm guessing it's one, but they can't use it. All of the leaders know it's a losing battle, and yet they're doing it anyway. Claire brings up the only thing she can offer, the one thing that still might have a chance to change things. Everything rested upon Charles Stewart. If they could take him out of the picture, things might turn around, or at least not go forward in the exact same way. Jamie is at first shocked and horrified. Now, of course, this is Claire talking about the death, or murdering, basically, murdering the prince. Claire says that she could do it. She could make a draft. Jamie says they'd kill her on the spot if he died while taking some of her medicine. And truly, in this moment, her life did seem worth the sacrifice to her if it would save so many others, and perhaps a nation. Though Claire truly did mean what she said, it doesn't mean that she said so or suggested such easily. At this point, Jamie had to physically support her. She could no longer stand. And that, of course, is evidence that she meant that she could do it and she would do it, but it still freaked her out that she was saying that she was even contemplating this. And she felt cold and sick with horror even as she said it. She then offers to put something in his food. And Jamie seriously, seriously contemplates all that she says. The problem is, Charles' death would not stop the rising. Those who were fighting were already considered traitors, their lives and property forfeit to the crown. But with Charles gone as the figurehead, the Highland army would dissolve. The English would still, however, pursue them. The only thing that might change if you take Charles out would be it could save the lives of the men who would die on the battlefield the next day. Now, it doesn't mean it would save their lives, period, but it might save their lives on the day. It is quite a conundrum. What do you all think about it? The one life versus 1,000, one life taken in cold blood versus 1,000 killed on the battlefield, which still may be followed and hunted throughout the Highlands and shot and killed anyway.
Well, and that's really the thing is, it's not even a case of, oh, there's no guarantee it would save those lives. It might save some lives, but it would still cost others. One of the lines I like in there is, the English terrorized and humiliated at Preston and Falkirk would not hesitate to pursue the fugitives, seeking to retrieve their lost honour and wash out the insult in blood. And at that point, that's what was going to happen, no matter what the Scottish army did, no matter what happened with Charles. They were going to go in there and basically go for genocide, because this was their only way of dealing with something like that. They had been insulted, and they had to avenge their pride.
The other thing to think about is that by this time the die was already cast as far as the famine. Like,
oh yeah,
it's April and it's freezing and dumping with rain and mucky and muddy and horrible. And even had there been any men to work in the farms in the Highlands at that point, the growing season that year was terrible. And that's the whole reason that Claire told Ian plant potatoes, because she knew that that was another thing that really caused problems, was the starvation caused by the bizarre weather that year that just caused such huge problems for even the people who were loyalists in Scotland at that point. Food prices went up, and the economics of the period of the Highland clearances was really impacted by just the agricultural conditions.
So what I was going to say is that the time for killing Charles Stewart passed from the moment he stepped on Scottish soil. It was too late. Okay. Like, if they were going to affect that change, it had to have happened when they were in France.
Yeah, it would have been great. And there's that scene in Paris where Jamie thinks about it just for a second. Like, Charles turns his back. I can't remember the exact moment, but... And there's that moment where Jamie looks at him and Claire sees what he's thinking, and and he can't do it then either, because he's got morals, darn it.
So just a quick heads up for you guys. We let the dogs in. They could not handle being in a room different from us.
They're being good, but...
So,
we'll be. Oh, I think the real question is, who let the dogs out?
No, I could hear him in the background a little bit, just a little bit, like the little, I think their collars kind of dangling.
Yeah, a little jingling, yeah.
Yeah, and then I heard...
They were whining in the very beginning.
Yeah, I heard a little bit of whine. It's cute, though. It's very homey.
It sets the mood for the whole episode. Exactly. Lots of whining and crying.
Jamie finally says, regarding killing the prince. Quote, I cannot. Would God that I could, Sassenach. I cannot do it. Unquote. And Claire is relieved. And then she sees Dougal MacKenzie standing in the doorway.
He ruins everything, that Dougal.
Dude, he does.
Oh, damn it, Dougal.
Damn it. Yeah, exactly. She sees that he's aged quite a bit. Claire describes it, and he now looks more like his brother Colm did. He's got gray and wrinkles he hadn't had just a few months before. This is completely understandable, seeing as what they've gone through the last few months. I always wonder, when there's a book or a scene or a movie or whatever, and someone looks up and there's someone in the doorway, or around the corner, or eavesdropping, or whatever, I always wonder, I ask the same question, how long were they there, and how much did they hear? Mm-hmm. How much? Because if you think about it, if all he heard, okay, maybe talk was enough. Talk about the possibility of will you do, can we do, should we do, was all Dougal. If he heard that, then he also heard both of them saying, we can't do this.
Yeah.
But that didn't matter to him.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, I guess it doesn't matter how much he heard. We know because he's so shocked and wanting to kill Claire, we know that he heard her talk about it. And he was standing there when they looked up, so he heard the end of it, where Jaime said, no, Sassenach, we can't do this. And then she was totally relieved.
Well, but if her back had been to him, and he didn't see the relief, and she didn't vocalize the relief, then all he heard was her telling him, we should kill him, and then him saying, that's a bad idea. And then Dougal comes in, and he's like, you are a witch, you're bewitching people and you have these terrible ideas and you just told him to do this and you're the traitor.
Well, and I think realistically at this point, Dougal's kind of lost his mind already. You know, his brother's died. His brother, who was always the brains of the operation, who was always the one guiding him and sort of taking care of him. And now his brother's dead and we're on this sort of terrible journey where everything he's dedicated himself to and worked towards and hoped for is just falling apart. He's going to be looking for someone to blame anyway.
Oh, yeah.
And it doesn't surprise me, like, even if it had been Jaime suggesting it and Claire saying no, I think at that point he would still come in there saying, well, she's bewitched you to think those things.
Yeah, he seems kind of paranoid, but then again, he's always sort of had it in for Claire because, I mean, I'm not a big believer in all the Freudian stuff, but he wanted her. He was interested in her. He was attracted to her, but also at the same time kind of like horrified by her because she didn't act like women were supposed to act, and she totally rebuked him multiple times. So it kind of stands to reason that there's something unnatural and wrong with her, because how could she resist him, and how could she act like that? And, you know, I really think that as a man of his time, it's possible that he really did think she was really a witch, or that at least there was something wrong with her. And he sees, like, his last hope. Jamie's, like, the last connection he's got. And there's Claire going, let's poison the prince. So, of course, he's going to be horrified and say, Jaime, what are you doing with this woman? Let me get rid of her for you.
Yeah, and let's not forget that Dougal was not his brother. His brother was the smarter, more even-headed. And Colm was the one that all those conversations about, did you set up Crane's Mirror? Did you mean to have me? And, you know, they talked about it. It's like, no, Claire, you were an accident. It was meant to get Galus. But those conversations are never with Dougal. They're with Colm. And so we don't know. Now, whether Colm truly believed that Galus was a witch, I mean, who knows? But I think that Dougal was much more superstitious along those lines than Colm. Colm was an opportunist, but Dougal, I think, whether it was more, even though the term didn't exist back then, whether it was more Freudian or whether it was truly that was the folk, I don't say folklore, that was life back then. If you couldn't, bless you.
That's the dog.
Oh, bless you, puppy. If you couldn't explain something and it was a woman, it was probably Satan or a witch.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Hey!
You know, you're outnumbered. It's pretty easy to talk like that, but we can mute me at any point.
Oh, my goodness. So, in case we're in any doubt about where he stands, Dougal says, quote, "filthy, treacherous, whoring witch." And Jamie reacts to this as though he'd been shot. Claire knocks over a bench as she quickly stands up. And Dougal has eyes only for her. And this time, it's not sexy eyes. That is, he has eyes for murdering her. Jamie puts himself between her and Dougal. Dougal accuses Claire of basically everything she had actually said and suggested, but then insults her, calls her a witch, other names, etc. And then he says he doesn't blame Jamie because she's bewitched him. He tells Jamie to stand aside so he can get rid of her. Dougal says that he will kill Jamie as well if he stands in his way. Dougal grabs for her, actually does grab her, and Jamie punches him. This leads to the two men fighting. Now remember, they're both left-handed. Other than the fact that they were actually trying to kill each other, it must have been a sight to behold. Then we see Jamie has struck Dougal at the base of the throat with his knife. And as he falls, Jamie catches his uncle. And as he's laying on the floor, spasming, he is actually trying to speak. Now, Claire sees Jamie's face change. Diana writes that his face went ashen, and it was clear to her that he could understand what Dougal was saying. Now, I didn't write this down, but I was thinking it when I took notes earlier. Do we ever find out what Dougal was saying?
Yes.
Is it in this book?
No, it's in one of the later books.
Oh, okay, so we can't talk about that.
I remember that we found out, but I can't remember what.
Me either. I mean, it's too much of a I'm going to give it to you but not tell you kind of thing for her not to give us later. Then there's another uninvited guest at the door. Willie Coulter, one of Dougal's men, makes his presence known with a "Blessed Michael, defend us." Now, Jamie reacts immediately. He knows that he's doomed. He asks for 1 hour to see Claire to safety, and then he'll return to answer for this. And Willie, with not knowing anyone else to say, agrees.
Now, is this the same Willie that we got to know in season one?
I've seen the name a few times, Willie Coulter.
I remember watching season one and going, who's Willie? I don't remember Willie from the books. But now that we've seen a Willie in the first book. We just saw the same one over and over again. Now that we were introduced to... there's no way for me to say that without it sounding like I'm talking about
a man named
penises.
William.
But he wasn't William. He was Willie.
Yeah.
But Willie's always short for something.
Sometimes they're not short. Anyway.
I didn't say they were short. I said they were short for something.
Oh, Lord.
I'm curly hair.
And there's no alcohol in our end of this conversation. Anyway, point being, when the name popped up in this book, I had a face to go with it.
Yeah.
A face?
Yes.
Not a Willie.
Not a Willie.
Sorry.
Face to go with the Willie.
Summer. Oh, Lord.
I was going to say, the thing that gets me about this one is, you know, we have, first of all, the reminder that Claire gave Colm the stuff to poison himself.
Oh, yeah.
And then we have the, well, we could use it on Charles. And then Dougal comes in and he's described as looking like Colm. Mm. How much he's aged, how haggard he is. And so Jamie's had the one uncle die, and we've had this sort of, you know, pressing of the other uncle, what's going to happen to him. He's just died. One of the Mackenzie men comes in after having just lost a second chieftain in pretty much as many months. And this is a really good show of how everyone's just starving and exhausted and falling apart. His reaction is not even just like shock of not immediately yelling murder and getting the guards. His reaction is that Jamie has time to go up and say, give me an hour, I promise I will definitely come back and answer for this. And he just goes, okay. And you have to think, in any other situation, in his right mind, he would have said no. He would have said, we have to get the guards. And it would have resulted in Jamie having to kill him as well. Just this show of how just shocked and falling apart everyone is anyway, that his reaction is, okay, sure, you can have an hour.
I'm sure it's also like those Snickers commercials where you're just not yourself when you're hungry.
You know, there's something to that. Like, when you're that seriously malnourished, your brain is not operating on all cylinders. But there's also the fact that Willie's used to doing what Jamie says. Jamie's the authority figure, and I'm sure Willie was also thinking, well, what am I going to do? Like, if he said no, he just watched Jamie kill somebody. You know, it could just as easily be, well, got to get Willie out of the way too, so I can go do what I'm going to do. Because I'm pretty sure Jamie would do that at this point.
Well, and he also walked in at on the end of it. So he didn't actually see what went down. So maybe part of him, because he is so, he trusts Jamie. There's a trust between them. Maybe he walked in. He's like, maybe there is a good excuse for this. Maybe I just need to wait and find out what happened.
I think it's
here.
A combination of what you said about how his nutritional insufficiencies.
Deficiencies?
Which is also an insufficiency, but yes, deficiency is the word I was looking for. His nutritional deficiencies, which definitely, definitely take a huge toll on the brain and the thinking processes. Combination of that with the scene that he's walked into, not just as like, is another Mackenzie dead, meaning the Mackenzie, the Laird, but it's Jamie holding this knife, or at least holding his uncle, and it's obvious that it was Jamie who did it.
Yeah.
So his mind is already crazy messed up. He knows the fact that this is the second Laird he's lost, and Jamie. So it's almost like he walks into this tableau, or in to see this tableau. It's incongruent with his life. It does not fit what is supposed to happen. And you have that on top of his starved mind. Yeah,
he was probably just totally stunned.
He was just out of everything. I think even in his right mind, he would have been stunned and he might have stuttered. Now, I think he probably would not have given him the hour. I agree. He may have still like hesitated before calling the police, before calling for the guard or something, because it was that shocking. I don't think he would have given him like 3 days to Sunday to go take care of whatever he's going to do with Claire. What I'm about to say is what I was referring to earlier. They get a reprieve so he can go take care of Claire, get her safe. As they leave and go downstairs, this line stops me. Quote, halfway down, he stopped. Leaning against the wall with his eyes closed, he drew deep, ragged breaths as though he were about to faint. And I put my hand on his chest, alarmed. His heart was beating like a drum and he was trembling. But after a moment, he drew himself upright, nodded at me, and took my arm. Unquote. Now, yes, he's a little bit messed up. That's why he's kind of resting. But the fact that he can pull himself together and nod at her and take a beat, take a moment to pull himself together, means that he was able to grab control. This is where I was talking about earlier. This is what I argue. This is the exact moment that Jamie revisits the conversation they'd had in Paris in the carriage. The moment he decides what he must do and what Claire must do. This, I believe, is the turning point for their relationship. Now, later on, of course, Diana points out through Claire that Jamie made up his mind. But I think it's right here. Up in the room when he's killed Dougal, he's having an oh shizzle moment, like, oh my gosh. But once he says out of his mouth, give me an hour to take care of my wife and see her to safety. He may have even known already up in the room what he was needed to do. But on the stairs, it hit him like a ton of bricks. I've got to do this. I've got to take her. She's going to be safe. And I've got to come back for these men.
I agree. It's pretty clear that, you know, he gives himself that one moment to feel the shock of, of Dougal's death and the horror. But I think you're right. I'm sure he's been thinking about, what am I going to do with Claire? Because he knows the battle's coming. He can't imagine that she's just going to sit and wait for him to maybe stumble out and then they're going to go live happily ever after. I think he's got to have had in mind for a while some plan for her. And it becomes really clear after he kills Dougal that, you know, he is positive that either the consequences of Dougal's death or this battle are going to be it for him. So...
Well, and I do wonder, it's never said explicitly in the book, but I wonder if in Claire's mind she's sort of always thinking, well, if we don't make this work, we can still go back to France. We can go be expats in France. She certainly would have known there were plenty of other higher up members of Scottish society that did that. But Jamie's never going to do that. His land and his family are on the line. His friends, his men, their lives are all on the line. They don't get to run away to France. They don't have the kind of lives where they can do that. And Jamie's never been the sort of person where he could leave them to their fate like that. And so I wonder if they've both been sort of casually thinking the what-ifs all along. You know, we see later on that Jamie had already had some things drawn up for eventualities. And I think this is just his moment where he sees this is going to happen. His world is literally falling down around his ears. And he has to do this thing. But the fact that he's Jamie and he's already planned for this sort of thing makes a big difference. Means he can have that moment, deal with it, and then go, okay, well, now I know what I'm doing. Now I need to do it.
And that's kind of how his personality's been. He's more of a preparer, and Claire's kind of a, well, we'll show up and see what happens. So not a surprise that she's pretty surprised by his preparedness.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'm kind of, well, I guess because she's determined to stay with him, I guess I can understand, at least on some level, why she's in so much denial, because she has no plan to leave him. Mm-hmm. And I can't say too much more because it's about future books, but wow.
Denial is certainly the right word.
Absolutely. They finish going down the stairs. They find Murta, and Jamie tells him that he's killed Dougal. Now, Murta's reaction is classic. Quote, Murta's face went quite blank for a moment. Then his normal expression of wary grimness reasserted itself. Aye, he said. What's to do then? Got it? What's Murta. Next? I know. He doesn't miss a beat. Jamie brings out a folded piece of paper from his sporran, a deed of sassine?
I know it's literally called sassin.
Sassin. Oh, okay, let's do that. A deed of sassin, which turns the lands of Brochturach to young Jamie, Jamie's nephew, the property to be held in trust by his parents, Jenny and Ian. It was dated July 1st, 1745, and it had two blank lines for witness signatures. Murta and Claire must sign it. It means forswearing themselves, he says, but it's the only way to keep the property safe from the English. Now, interesting, Claire is leaving a legal document signed by her in the past. We can't say too much more about that either, right?
Not yet.
Because references are in the future. Okay, so Fergus is told that he will take the deed to Lallybroch. Jamie tells him, quote, this must reach my sister without fail. It is worth more than my life, man, or yours, unquote. He tells Fergus to go to the stable, show a ring that he gives him to old Alec, so old Alec can't be dead, most likely then, and take Donis to Lallybroch. Jamie has Murta gather the men. He will see Claire safe and then return. Before he leaves, Murta says, quote, let it be the English, not your ain folk, unquote. Now, do you guys think he means be sure it's the English that take your life?
I think so. That's what I took from it. But that line definitely gave me pause the first time I read it because it's not super clear. It definitely seems like Murta and Jamie have sort of been having this silent communication.
Well, and I wonder if it's just the twofold. If Jamie gets killed in the battle, people will see Jamie get killed in the battle. Anyone who's able to take news back home to Lallybroch, it's going to be, and he fought valiantly, died. Whereas if he's killed by some of the Mackenzies, it's probably not going to be such an honourable and pretty death. And the word's going to get around very quickly with those who do survive what Jamie did and that they killed him for it.
Well, it's the option of dying a traitor's death or dying like a hero, dying with your boots on, you know. So Murta's just looking out for Jamie like he does.
Now Jamie takes Claire and they're off. Now she didn't know what he'd meant when he'd said, I shall see my wife safe. But within 2 hours of writing, she knows.
Mm-hmm.
And her reaction is heartbreaking and lovely. Even getting like a tear prick now, when I imagine that, I mean, they may change it, obviously. It may not be exactly the same. But I can now imagine Katrina saying the line,
yeah,
saying no I said when I saw it and realized where we were headed. Jamie, no, I won't go. And that's that. I mean, the whole thing is freaking sad. The whole thing is devastating. But that bit right there, it's like she's had up until now denial and she's still saying this. No, no, I can't. I won't. I can't. I won't. And you can't make me. And later on, when she talks about the heartbreak, which is, I'll say something about that line in a little bit. Her heart begins to break right here. It's not later on, it's right here.
Yeah, and she's, you know, Jamie's the stubborn one. He's very determined. He's had his little breakdown, and he knows he'll have the rest of his feelings later.
Or he'll die first, which is his kind of plan.
Which is exactly, he's going to, the plan or the thing that they, all things going to happen, and it's supposed to happen, because people typically did not survive Culloden. If they did, they were shot.
People typically? Well, like it happened all the time?
You know.
Jamie knows that very few people survived.
Well, yes. One thing this book does not cover, this is actually the fourth Culloden.
And no one survives, ever, typically.
Oh, Arlen.
Yeah, Jamie just, he has decided. And, you know, you hear that with people sometimes, that when they realize they're going to die, you know, they decide, this is what needs to be done, and I'm going to do it. And I really think Jamie is past the point of caring and realizes that really all he can do at this point is take care of Claire and face the music. So
you can also then, from what you just said, I think you're right. I mean, right now he knows there's like, obviously no turning back. It's a done deal. I just have to execute it now. But you could say, you know, talking about, I'm not talking about changing history. I'm not talking about when could things no longer go back. But I think probably besides the prince, well, actually, this is in line with what you said. This is in line with the prince coming to, no, you guys said not when he came to Scotland. You guys said when he went into England. I do agree with that.
Yeah.
But also, if the prince had been not precluded, if he had been kept from coming to Scotland in the first place, obviously that's what they were trying to do, right? Early on.
Yeah, exactly. They went to France in the first
place. Exactly. Now, the thing where I think it was probably no turning back was when they were at Lallybroch and he gets that mail of his forged signature.
Mm-hmm.
And he lets out that scream that threw Claire, like gave her shivers. I mean, that to me is where things, besides the fact that they were unsuccessful in Paris, besides that, which is a big thing, this is the no turning back, because not only is the prince here, I'm effed. I'm a traitor. I'm a traitor now. Even if I hide in the basement, I'm a traitor now, doing nothing. So I may as well help the cause.
Well, I think also once you decide that your death is inevitable, you want to choose the way you go. If you can,
or at least have an
option. Yeah, and you're like, I'm going to die. I would like to,
over the fact that you are going to die. You want to have control of the stuff that happens that you can control before that.
Right.
I agree.
I was just going to say, I find it really interesting, and I wonder if Diana planned this beforehand or not, that he has been to the Stones with Claire previously and had his little tantrum about the fact that he can't hear or feel them or anything. So he doesn't have any other way out. Like, he knows he can see Claire safe, but at this point, you know, she's not even considering it, but he knows this is going to be their separation and he's going to send her through, and he cannot follow. He already knows that when he's made this decision.
So, whereas if they hadn't done that before, but he still believed her, and they were doing that now, and he thinks, oh my gosh, could you imagine? To me, that would be even worse. Thinking, look, this is awful. I don't know if I'll survive in your time, but homegirl, let's go. Let's save my family with this deed. You know, not notarize it, but sign it. Get it safe. Save the property. And then I'm going to go with you back to the 20th century. If they didn't know, and that was the plan, and then they found out that he couldn't go, to me, that would have been worse. Holy monkeys. But yeah, no, you're right. I think it's very, I wonder if Diana had that as, maybe not on purpose, but had it in mind, and being a kind of a, not having that as an out, or even a possible out.
Yeah, I would say that's probably how she was planning it, at least.
Mm-hmm. So on the way to the Stones, literally right there, they stop at the same cottage they'd been at before, the old ruin of a cottage. Claire begins to apologize to him. She says if she'd only gone back the first time he brought her here, maybe, ... But Jamie cuts her off and says that if she'd gone back, things would likely have progressed to the way they were now, only a little bit slower, more slowly, or maybe slightly differently. Little things may have been different, but the Culloden would likely, it would have still come to Culloden. Now she corrects him. I don't mean that. She says, I mean, I'm sorry for what I did to you. And he smiles and says, and what have I done to you? I led you into poverty and outlawry through battlefields, and I've risked your life. She tries unsuccessfully to allow him to let her stay with him. She even suggests they go to France. And he says no, the ports are closed. He's a traitor twice over, to the Scots and to the English. He's a dead man. Quote, Red Jamie wouldn't get far, but you, I can save you, Claire, and I will. That is the most important thing. But then I shall go back for my men, unquote. So his plan is to lead his men away from the battle to save them in the confusion that is sure to reign. And then he'll return to the battle once he's seen his men safe on their way to Lallybroch. Quote, I'm not afraid to die, Sassenach, unquote. He mentions a number of ways he may die on the battlefield. And in addition to the traitor's death, which is what he, of course, doesn't prefer, the terror rises up in her, and then it is gone. Quote, then all at once, the fear left me. I could not leave him, and I would not, unquote. Lisa T. writes, this, of course, reminds us of the scene when Monsieur Foret explained to Jamie and Claire what happens to a traitor just before he is killed is a horrible, dishonorable, gruesome death. Claire is very calm. She tells him she will be going back with him. She plans to pass as a man and to die on the field with him. And Jamie says, quote, do you think I don't know? This is a hard line to read.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't envy you that job. It's tough stuff.
Well, and especially in the face of it. Her standing there saying, well, I'm just going to dress as a dude and go and fight. And it's this sort of very 1940s, I grew up going to Egypt and, you know, reading romantic novels kind of, well, I'm just going to defy the odds and somehow pass as a man and go die by your side. And their time, that is unlikely and unreasonable, and there are other things to consider.
Well, and, you know, Jamie calls Claire brave probably at least 4 times during the course of this chapter, and in the other books it's something he comes back to, that it's something he loves about her, is that she's not afraid of anything. And it's that sort of sweet, dumb denying bravery that, like, she just refuses to accept that things are not going to go the way she wants them to, and she will find a way to make them be the way she wants them to be. And Jamie is there to kind of be the voice of reality and say, you know, sometimes you have to make decisions in a different way than just forcing them to be the way you want, you know?
Probably nowhere more so than here. And Jamie says, quote, do you think I don't know? It's me that has the easy part now. For if you feel for me as I do for you, that I'm asking you to tear out your heart and live without it, unquote.
This makes me think of Hamilton the musical. They say it several times. Dying is easy, living is harder.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's
so what his role in this is, the easier of the two. He just has to go out there and die, whereas she has to go and...
She has to live.
And live, so...
And I hope they keep that verbatim. I really do, because that right there, it's me that has the easy part now.
She's greeting.
I'm greeting. A little greeting. Okay.
So Claire's... Hey, I read this chapter at my desk at work earlier.
Oh, me too. Well, not today, but like in 1999. Sorry.
Yeah. You know, I didn't even try and explain to my coworkers what I was doing. Sitting there mopping my tears up and in between phone calls.
In between phone calls. Claire asks, why must she do it? Quote, when you took me from the witch trial at Cranesmere, you said then that you would have died with me. you would have gone to the stake with me, unquote. He says he would have. But then he says, but I wasn't a carrying your child. He knows, and we already knew this, they've already had discussion about this, but he knows her cycle better than she does. Even in the middle of a war, he's been counting the days.
That's how you know Jamie is a total, like, unrealistic dream man. Like, he's interested in Claire's period. Like, yes. What else do you need?
Lisa T. writes, next follows perhaps the most heartbreaking scenes in the entire series as all of the pieces of the puzzle finally come together. Jamie says, Claire, tomorrow I will die. This child is all that will be left of me ever. I ask you, Claire, I beg you, see it safe.
That's his trump card, because what's she going to say to that?
She can't.
No, the baby's going to die too, and it's all your fault.
Exactly.
Well, they don't even know that the baby's going to make it through the stones. I mean, they don't even know that she can travel back with the baby. So, I mean, it's just their only chance. It's their only and best chance.
Yeah. And then, so Lisa, and I don't disagree. Lisa said that the scenes coming up were probably the most heartbreaking of the series. And I agree. This chapter is, these scenes is why this is my favorite book. Because it is so awful, so wonderful, so beautifully written, and so, at least in the book, well acted. I mean, I guess you can't act in a book, but it's so amazing that I've never read anything that has come really close to this at all. And this, to me, is the part that is just slightly more sad. The saddest thing to me that Jamie says is, do you think I don't know it's me that has the easy part now? This is the saddest thing that I think I wrote, then perhaps the saddest words in all of the thus far 8 books. Definitely at least the saddest that Claire has in the books. Quote, in that moment, I heard my heart break. It was a small, clean sound, like the snapping of a flower's stem. Unquote. And I cannot do it justice, but if you listen to Davina say that, her voice gets lighter, and I can't say bland, but there's not a ton of emotion in it. It's like the voice of someone who is observing something from afar. And it's so effective. And if you have not listened to this, any of them, I mean, we love Davina, so we think you'd really like it. But if you have not listened, you, at least book two. I mean, don't skip book one, but book two. Davina, it's a whole other experience listening to her. Read it first if you must, but listening to her will brings different things. Each time.
See, and I really love her style of reading.
Yeah.
But we actually have a friend right now who is deployed and has been very bored during the periods of Hurry Up and Wait. And so I sent the audiobooks out, and apparently he had to go to reading the actual books because her voice puts him to sleep.
Aww.
And I was like,
she is very soothing.
And
she
is. I said to him, is it just that, like, you know, she's really soothing, or is she really boring? And he was like, no, she just has such a lovely voice. I get so relaxed and go to sleep.
Absolutely. That's why I have a sleep timer. Whenever I listen to an audiobook with her, I have to put it on like 15 minutes so I fall asleep, because if otherwise it'll keep going and I'll wake up 8 hours later, 7 hours later, and she'll finish the book. So I don't know where I was. So I put on sleep timer, even though it is also kind of annoying, but I still do it.
You know, I think when she says that about the flower stem, it's, you know, it really is this wonderful moment of being absolutely resigned. Like, there's just nothing else that's going to happen, and she's accepted this horrific fate. And I think it's a few lines later where he says to her, Lord, you gave me a rare woman, and God, I loved her well. And that one's always interested me, because at least in my experience of relationships, you don't necessarily think you're doing the best job 100% all the time. There's always that room for doubt of, am I a good enough boyfriend or spouse or whatever? And I think it's perhaps that moment of fatality right at the end where, you know, he knows there's nothing else he can do. He's doing the best he can do by her at this point. And so he's able to say that he loved her well, that he did it right, knowing that he loves her as much as he does, and he's given everything he can. And I think that's a little bit poignant because this is the point where they're both accepting completely, like, this is happening.
Yeah. It's, they both have, yeah, they both have given up everything. They both are, they're resigned, and they know they have now only borrowed time before, basically, before their worlds end in different ways. So Claire agrees to go. Then Jamie says, quote, "I will find you." Isn't that from a movie? I will find
Daniel
you.
Daniel Day-Lewis, Last of the Mohicans.
Sorry. one of our father's favorite movies.
I saw it like eight times in the movie theater.
With Dad?
Arlen's never seen it.
When I've been Arlen! On
a long time.
It's such a good movie.
It is wonderful.
Oh my. I mean,
Although every bagpipe band in this area has to play that song like it's a pissing contest. Like, and it's a near thing. I'm almost fed up with it, but it's such a good tune. Yeah, we'll get him one of these days. Maybe we'll read that series next. Oh, my gosh.
Okay, put it this way. If I ever come visit, or when I come visit.
Yeah, when.
We're watching that, girl.
Perfect.
And sounds boy. And boy.
While drinking mead.
I don't care. I'm not picky. I'll drink whatever you have.
I have a ton of mead in the cupboard right now.
Oh, there you go.
Okay. So he says, quote, "I will find you, I promise. If I must endure 200 years of purgatory, 200 years without you, then that is my punishment which I have earned for my crimes. For I have lied and killed and stolen, betrayed and broken trust. But there is one thing that shall lie in the balance. When I shall stand before God, I shall have one thing to say, to weigh against the rest. Lord, you gave me a rare woman, and God, I loved her well." Unquote.
That was a really weird punctuation. I'm looking at that sentence. It is. And it's like, they put the exclamation point
after God,
and then made "I loved her well" a completely period. Second statement. Yeah. I was like, because it seems like that should have been a comma. Like, you gave me a rare woman, and God, I loved her well.
If it was God, comma, then you're addressing God, which this kind of is. But I think with the God exclamation point, it's more of like an exclamation like, you gave me this rare, because Lord is addressing God, right? Lord, you, Mr. Person, you gave me a rare woman, and criminy,
you gave me a rare woman, and he's also calling her a god.
I'm glad we're sentence diagramming like the most famous lines this entire series.
No, and I love never. It. It's like,
and now you're listening to Grammar with the Outliners podcast.
We have to do whatever we can to distance ourselves from how heartbreaking this chapter is.
My gosh. We have to find every single possible tangent. Oh, gosh. So they make love slowly and carefully to savor and remember each other. She then sleeps for a bit.
So is this going to be like the first time that's anyone's like filmed like sad sex? Like, it's going to be sad
sex. What about the part in season one before he takes her to the stones after Cranesmere? Oh, gosh, that scene made me cry a lot.
Yeah. Yes.
That was
especially because she doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Oh gosh, that makes it worse.
Yeah, but won't this make it at least 50% worse knowing that this time both know it?
Way more.
Like, because, he knew. So, I mean, his methods during that scene were his, inner monologue.
Look, Jamie may have had friends in his head.
His inner monologue, was one thing. And whereas she didn't know what was coming, so she was just like, "Oh, this is a really intense
I enjoy coupling, this, Jamie.
Right?
Thank you."
Thank you. Whereas this time around, it's just, This is it. Let's make it count.
So they do it, and they savor each other, and they do it to remember each other by. She then sleeps for a bit. And then, a little bit later, when she awakes, she asks him to mark her, to cut her deep enough to leave a scar. He carves a J into the base of her thumb. And she does the same for him, but carving a half moon, so to mimic a C. Jamie tells her if she can bring herself to speak of him to Frank, and Frank will listen, to tell him that he's grateful. He trusts him, because he must. And to tell him that he hates him to his guts and to the marrow of his bones. Oh, go that Jamie.
So Jamie.
This is the chapter after he had his tantrum, or two chapters after. Damn all Randalls. That was one chapter after. Yeah, last chapter is like, all Randalls. So Jamie,
I also like that he throws in that, let him know that I really loved you and I totally trust him to take care of you. Because, you know, at that point it's a case of, well, if Randall's any sort of a decent man, then he's going to do it anyway, but just in case he's not, we're going to guilt him into it. What a great man Jamie is. You better live up to this.
Exactly.
And every man since that has been going, damn it, Jamie Fraser, you're ruining it for everybody else.
Exactly. Every husband out there whose wife has read this book. Or boyfriend, whatever. Or girlfriend.
A girlfriend, well, yeah.
I could be a girlfriend. Jamie says that in the old days, a man would find a wise woman to bless him before doing a great deed. She would come up behind him, say a prayer, and he'd walk in the direction he had to go, not looking back. He says to Claire, bless me then, wise woman, and go. She says the words of a prayer of protection that she'd heard from Jenny. But not so fast. There's a sound of voices and footsteps. Jamie pushes her away toward the back of the cottage where the wall has fallen away, and she can ostensibly get out through there. She turns for one last look at him. They take each other one last time, very quickly. And then he kisses her once more and says, name him Brian for my father.
Famous last words.
And he turns to face the English. Claire makes a run for the stone circle. Someone had seen her run from the cottage up to the stones and is pursuing her. She runs to the circle and then stops and looks back to see what is happening. The final paragraph of the chapter reads, quote, all at once, the brush below me parted with a flash of red. An English soldier. I turned, ran gasping across the turf of the circle, and hurled myself through the cleft in the rock.
So this unquote. Would be like just a little different from when she tried to get through the stones in the first season, whereas she got up to it and then we thought she went and then they pulled her away. This would be like the exact difference. Yeah,
she's
the
exact herself. Opposite. Yeah. Her
but there's no cleft. So she can't really hurl herself through the stones because it's just one big stone in the middle that she's good.
You're talking about
through.
The series,
right? I'm just trying to imagine how this is going to play out.
I would guess they'll probably show her sort of reaching out, and at the point where you think her hand's going to actually touch the stone, or just as it touches it, she'll sort of
disappear,
either melt into the stone or just start fading away.
I wonder if they'll even bother showing it because they didn't show it in the first season.
I would think they would. Tend to do it more like they did in the first season, where it's kind of like a flash of light or a fade to black, that kind of thing, where she's running toward the stones and then...
And you hear the sound.
Yeah.
And then it goes.
Yeah, and then another season of Claire magically losing all of her clothes.
Yeah.
One piece at a time.
Or I wonder if they'll revisit the car accident scene again, where they're every time she goes through the stones, you see Claire in the backseat of a car and then the tumbling and the light. And then all of a sudden, she's on the ground again.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, they've already got the footage.
Exactly. They'll just recycle it.
Exactly.
It's just good fiscal sense.
It is.
Very Scottish.
That is true. But Claire's not Scottish. Lisa T. writes, we finally understand why Claire had to come back through the stones, why she had to leave Jamie. Not only is Claire devastated to be parted from Jamie, she is sure that he will die. Quote, sinning daily and not repenting, the fear of death disturbs me. For there is no redemption in hell. Have mercy on me, O God, and save me. Unquote. Timor mortis conturbat me. Indeed. Claire is deeply disturbed at the thought of Jamie's death and the deaths of so many that she could not prevent. And so are we all.
Yeah, it's... I mean, completely aside from all the other heartbreak, I think the one part that always gets me is that she starts going and Jamie hurries her along and says, hey, they're English coming. She hears the brush. She gets to glance an English soldier, but then all she can do is run and throw herself at the stones. And she doesn't even get a chance to look back and get that one last glance at Jamie before she steps through.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you're right.
While it's not exactly the same thing, when Diane and I were still not living in the same country, we ended up with a horrific fear of airports because of the amount of goodbyes we had to say. And I would always have this horrible moment, like when I was going through the gate away, I would, you know, walk Royal and then I would turn around and see her, and she was always standing in the same place, and I felt just like horrible and abandoning her, and it was really terrible. And I would have to just keep walking, and eventually there would be a point where I would look back and I couldn't see her anymore. And I can't imagine, like, as horrible as that was, how difficult it would be for Claire to just go up to the stones and go through and know she couldn't even take a second to look back. There wasn't that option for her.
Well, but she was kind of, at that point, fleeing because there was a chance that someone would stop her.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's an awful moment because she's got that concern for what's happening with Jamie right now and who are those soldiers and not wanting to go. It's a tough moment. And I don't think it's any mistake that Diana does use that image about childbirth in this chapter, that there are these painful things that you go through that you really, the only way to get relief is to just keep going. And in that situation, Claire just has to go. She can't even contemplate another option. So, and she goes.
And that was the abrupt end of chapter 46.
Yeah, for such a dramatic chapter and all the stuff that, for something so huge and so horrible and so devastating and so tragic that you know, that happens. It ends almost anticlimactically because it is. This is no fade to black. This is shock to black.
Mm-hmm.
This is not Anne scene. This is like, Saint, she's gone. She's gone and it ends. It ends.
Maybe it's like the Hogwarts Express, that 9 3/4, where they just kind of run at the wall and they just kind of like go through. That's what happens. That's what I think happens.
Well, if they have her pushing a luggage cart in the TV show, it'll probably take the edge off how sad that is.
That would
it
be
would.
So funny.
That would have meant she had much more time to plan.
Absolutely.
Suddenly there were suitcases. I know. So the time leading up to Culloden couldn't have been that bad. They probably weren't starving. So thank you to our friends Arlen and Diane, or Diane and Arlen, for joining us and being our reinforcements, helping us get through this, not just get through the chapter, but add a total, that's really bad English, add a lot to the conversation.
Thanks for having us. I really was not sure how any of us would get through this podcast without like gratuitous sobs, but I think we all held each other up.
It was good to be back on.
Oh, we just had to break some sentences down grammatically and then
there
we're,
you
all,
go.
We're all doing okay.
Right.
And like I put out on Twitter a few days ago, looking forward, not to scare anybody, but start making your Voyager read-along plans, because as long as we get, as long as we get season 3 announcement, which I think everyone's pretty, I can't say confident, but pretty hopeful and decently confident that will come at some point, we will be starting the Voyager read-along, likely the week after the show ends, which means we're going to have to record it before the show ends in order to have it up in time. So
we can't even take a week to like
chill.
We could take an episode and just talk about how we feel about it. We gotta rush right in.
No, you're right, we do.
Besides,
but we have to plan it.
We haven't even finished Dragonfly and Amber yet. Can we not, Summer, talk about Voyager?
I'm not saying talk about it.
We've got 2 or 3 chapters and it's not a lot, but come on.
Anyway, all I'm saying is hopefully, knock on wood, coming up, and if you guys would like to be part of it, start scoping out those chapters.
Absolutely.
I can think of one right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, I have to be there for all of them, but if I was going to pick one,
don't say it, just start thinking about Voyager and what chapters you guys want to lay claim to.
Okay,
sounds good. Okie doke. Take it out.
Okay, have a great night and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Good
night.
You take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our Audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod or email us at OutlanderPod@gmail.com.